Hey, hey, welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We have hit the All-Star break. It is July 9th. I'm Scott Pianowski, and I'm really excited to be talking to one of our repeat guests, one of our Yahoo guys, just a staple of this podcast and a reason why I think we've had a nice first season so far, Mr. Fred Zinke. Aloha.
Hey, Scott, how are you? I will already start by disagreeing with you on something. It is July 8th. However, it's a great time to lose track of your days because, let's be honest, none of the next 3 days really matter in baseball when we're on the All-Star break.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, is it the 8th or the 9th? And for some reason, I remembered the 4th of July as being on a Wednesday, but it turned out to be on a Thursday. It was so funny that I thought the big fantasy player on the 4th of July was Jansen, the Toronto catcher. And, you know, he kind of trolled America and took control of the day. Did you have any Jansen, by the way? Before we get into it, we're going to be talking hits and misses and takeaways from the first half. And then we have a draft that Fred actually came up with a concept. I'm not going to spoil it yet, but it's going to be the most important draft in the history of mankind. But before we get to that, just because I mentioned Jansen, Fred, you are the Toronto guy. I always want to get your information from the team that you're so close to. Did you draft any of Jansen before the season? And what do you think of his recent spark of home runs?
So I hate to say this, but I drafted Jansen on one team and I dropped him. He was so bad. I mean, for the first couple of months, and I decided I wouldn't drop him. It's two catcher league and I wouldn't drop him unless I found someone I liked. Christian Vasquez was up on waivers 1 week. I only kind of regret dropping him because Vasquez has been really good for me. Yeah. So I kind of do regret dropping him just because he's really come around. I can't remember who my other catcher was on that team. I think it was someone who was good enough. I think it was Wilson Ramos maybe or someone. But anyway, so I drafted him on one team. I was interested. I was in there for him in every draft. So I was a believer. But then it was just going so badly that I felt like he was just ruining my batting average and I had to let him go.
The fact that you've cut Jansen, now it's great that you picked up Vasquez. That's a net win, and I certainly feel better about Vasquez going forward. But if you never make a regretful cut in a fantasy season, you're playing far too conservatively. It'd be like the poker player who never gets caught bluffing. If you're never caught bluffing in poker, if you're never caught stealing on the base paths in baseball, you're not running enough. You're not trying to improve yourself enough. You're not taking what's there to be taken enough. So if you're going to look back and say, I think in a successful season, yeah, I didn't play this one right. I should have been more patient here. I was too patient there. Some of the stuff will only make sense in the retelling. And sometimes we really don't know why things worked out or didn't work out. You don't want to falsely attribute things, just see patterns in the clouds. But when people are looking back at their first halves and they see drops, if you don't see some regretful drops, I think you're playing far too conservatively.
No, it's true. In fact, I think on one of my teams, I might have dropped Lucas Giolito. Like, I might have picked him up really early in April just for a spot start. And then that spot start was just okay. And then I dropped him. But, you know, I mean, you always talk about churning that bottom part of your roster. If you're churning the bottom part of your roster, sometimes, you know, you're going to drop someone and then regret it. And it just is what it is. It's better to do that than to just hold these guys. I mean, maybe you find a Giolito, but maybe you end up just holding, you know, some Brad Keller type guy for months waiting for him to come around and it just never happens. So, yeah, I think that's just part of it. I always think back 1 year, many years ago in Tout Wars, the year that R.A. Dickey won the Cy Young, mm-hmm. I almost dropped him. I think I bought him for $2 in the auction and he was like okay in April, but to me, he wasn't like a guy I had to keep on my roster. And I was thinking about dropping him 1 week in April and I was like, no, I'll keep Dickey. He's okay. Anyways, and then obviously he had that great season, but yeah, it just happens sometimes. It doesn't mean you don't know what you're doing. It's just those fringe players. Sometimes it takes a while before they jump up and we really notice them.
Pretty sure I cut Dickey somewhere in that league. I did one of the worst things you can do. I picked him up and watched him pitch, and he got hammered that day. And yeah. The knuckleball, there are no rules for knuckleballs. I mean, they can go good for a while. They can go bad. We know when knuckleballers don't have it, they tend to get their lunch handed to them. But I caught him. I think it was a rainy day, maybe in Atlanta, and he pitched poorly. And I thought, why am I picking up R.A. Dickey? Caught him and probably kept me from some fantasy glory that season. As we said, the All-Star break, it's a great time to take stock in what's happened, where are your teams at, who can contend, what do you need to do, where did you go right, where did you go wrong. And we're going to start doing that with Fred. Let's start with some of the things we got right. I know this is going to sound like victory laps, and you know, Fred and I are not, we're not generally the home run pose guys. I don't think Fred celebrates like Derek Dietrich when he gets something right. For one thing, he gets things right more often than Derek Dietrich does. But the key is going to be trying to figure out what the takeaway was and what the learning point was, or what can we invest in the future that we may have learned from what's already happened in the first half of the season. So Fred, let's start these mini victory laps, these teaching points. give us something that you got right from the first half of the season.
Yeah, when we started talking about this, when I really look at what I got right, I look at which players I own the most, because that's kind of putting your money where your mouth is. I mean, you can talk about a player, but if you're not the one drafting him, you know, you're not really the one who believes in him the most. The player I own on most of my the most teams is Eddie Rosario. And I was really big on him as a potential top 25, top 30 hitter this year. My takeaway on Rosario was just that he kind of did break out last season, but no one noticed because then he got the nagging injuries and really tailed off. So his second half numbers were so poor that by the end of the season, you're like, oh, it's just another Eddie Rosario season. You know, people were looking back on him last year. Okay, he hit 288 with 24 homers. That's fine. When I took a deeper look at him, first half of last year, he hit 311 with 19 home runs, 60 RBIs, and then the nagging injuries came and then he tailed off. So the lesson I tried to learn from him was just break last season down. And when you're looking for your breakouts, maybe look for someone who did break out and then injuries robbed them of that full season breakout, because they're the guy who, and I'm not ready to take the victory lap on Rosario because he hasn't been great the last few weeks. And the same thing, he's injured right now, and the same thing could happen again this year. But I'm feeling pretty good overall that he's off to such a good start. I think this could be the full season breakout.
I love players that I call excused absence players, where something didn't go right in the previous season, but there's a very logical, explainable reason for that. And maybe they're discounted anyway because people are a little bit disenchanted. And when a player was hurt, I mean, that's one of the greatest things you can have for an excused absence, especially if it leads to the player being somewhat discounted the next year. And again, it wasn't that Rosario was a giveaway in price, but he was priced at a pocket that I don't think fully considered that he was playing at a first round or like top 20 level in the first half of the season. So it's a case of, I know we probably would sleep better at night if players produced at an even level the full season, we could know what they were going to do and everything. But it's actually when somebody has the jagged splits that Rosario did, I think that sets up a better buying opportunity, because the first half you represent the upside. The second half, at least you can relate it to injury. And he's still young enough that I wouldn't be worried about injuries being a chronic problem with Rosario. I think there's a lot of good advice there. And that was a really nice call. Again, it hasn't maybe been a home run, but he certainly got on base with Rosario. One of my predictions this year was that Kirby Yates would lead the league in save. Now, to be fair, I put that in a bold predictions column. My idea was that I think it's more likely than people probably give it credit for. He was the second tier closer I was targeting last year after Han was traded. The Padres made Yates their closer. He got all the saves after Han left, so there was no sharing it with anybody else. I thought San Diego improved enough that maybe they could be quasi contenders. And I really didn't want to go after the first tier, the closers, you know, especially the Diazes and the Trinans. They really only had that one monster season. I think if you're buying at the high end of those ranges, that could be a mistake. And thus far, it's all gone to plan. I don't have any Diaz. I don't have Diaz. Whatever his name is, I don't have him. Thank God for that. I don't have a lot of Blake Trinan. Part of that's injury, but he wasn't really pitching well before he got hurt, maybe because of the injury. And I know, look, any strategy works if you pick the right players. And the fact that Yates is doing so well, and the Padres, you know, again, Petco, they win a lot of close games. It's not the pitcher great, the hitting graveyard it used to be, but it's still a place where you expect the Padres to win 4-2 and 5-3 and 3-1, and that fits into Yates. Of course, he's been, you know, just fantastic with the strikeout rate and everything. But I think this reiterates that I like to get good, solid guys I believe in who I don't think are trampled by the rest of the world. And not that people didn't know who Kirby Yates was, not like I got him in every league, but at least people didn't go into their draft like saying, hey, I got to get Kirby Yates. You know, he's the top of my board. Or I just don't think he was a sexy player to a lot of people. And to me, those boring middle round unsexy guys, or in this case, a tier two closer, a lot of times they end up being good investments.
For sure. I think maybe tier two is the place to go with closers. The success rate once you go down, I think, to tier three and lower is really poor, either because the closer skills are poor or because the closer's in tier three because he's on a really bad team and, you know, the save chances will be fewer and far between, and he's also a trade candidate. Yates kind of fit that nice middle ground where, like you said, like he wasn't going with Kenley Jansen and Edwin Diaz, but he was, you know, a skilled closer on a team that was supposed to be at least competitive. And I agree with you on that whole theory of San Diego and their home park, you know, playing those. And that even goes for a lot of parks in that division, right? With San Francisco, Los Angeles, even Arizona a little bit now, you know, low to medium scoring games and should get plenty of save chances. So, no, I think you hit right on there. And I know you were someone who was really on Trinan last season, which worked out really well. I think looking for those closers who have the skills and opportunity to jump up a level is probably the right thing to do.
But I hadn't thought about this, but actually, if you went with any of the inexpensive closers in that division, you've done really well. Will Smith, we'll see how much longer he's with the Giants. And that's a fascinating thing there. I've been getting as much Dyson as I can, a little bit of Watson here, a little bit of Maranta there. But I think Will Smith will be traded. The problem is the Giants should really trade all their relievers if they can. They should burn that thing to the ground. So I don't know who's left in the ninth inning for that team. But Smith has been great. A lot of people didn't want to touch Greg Holland, but he's been a value too. So if you went with a cheap closer in that division, it's certainly been good for you. Wade Davis, of course, you know, Colorado, the rules are just different there. But anyway, that's one I got right. Let's go back to you, Fred. Give us one of your hits from 2019.
Yeah, I really hit on, we'll stick with pitchers. I really hit on Wade Miley, who I own on almost all of my teams. Like, Miley hasn't been amazing, but he's certainly been very good. He's done exactly what I thought he would do in the high case scenario where, you know, I just really believe in Houston and what they can do with pitchers. And then there were some other things I kind of liked about Miley, namely that he was okay with Milwaukee last year. And I was not a Wade Miley guy for most of his career, but with Milwaukee last year, he was pretty good. 257 ERA, 355 FIP. So it's not like it was all luck. Going to Houston, the run support, the defense, the home park. I just felt like he could kind of just back his way into a dozen wins. And then if everything went, you know, really well, maybe even 13 or 14, and then the ratios would be fine. And so far, so good. And he's kind of doing what I thought. Like, it's a 328 ERA, but a 432 FIP. But I don't really care with the 432 FIP because that's not a fantasy category. So he can go ahead and outpitch his FIP because of their good defense, you know, all season. And I just think he's not a sexy guy to have, but he's the kind of guy that you can, for most matchups, you can just leave him in your lineup knowing that he has the better team supporting him.
So many good takeaways there. I love to, when I have trust in an organization, I love to bet on what they're betting on. I love to bet where the Astros bet. I love to bet where Tampa Bay bets. I love to bet where the Indianapolis Colts are betting. Every one of the Indianapolis Colts draft choices made the team last year.
Yeah.
And they found Eric Ebron, the tight end for the Lions. Not that I'm trying to turn this into a football podcast, but you know, Ebron would basically run out of Detroit and they turned him into a 14 touchdown guy. So again, I'll bet with the Colts, I'll bet with the Rays, and I'll certainly bet with the Astros. I'm not sure exactly what's the reason for their special sauce with their pitching. I mean, some people will say they're doing some things with spin rate that are smart. Other people will say maybe they're doing some stuff they shouldn't be doing, but they're smart. They understand framing. They understand defense. That park is very quietly a pitcher's park. And I love that you talked about FIP and Miley up producing it. And it's important to know advanced stats can give us a lot of illumination and a lot of tips and a lot of guideposts, but we have to. ERA is what we use. Batting average is what we use. And if somebody, say, has a lifetime BABIP over the league average, he owns that, and he's learned how to get a BABIP that's unusually high. Because maybe he's fast. Maybe he plays in a park that increases BABIP. In the case of Miley, while we have to know that maybe he's not quite as good as he's pitched in real life, we're not trying to sign into a contract ourselves. We're not trying to run the Houston Astros. We just want ERA from it. So that's a great point that even though these metrics are very useful, just understand what they say and what they don't say, and understand when their back of baseball card stats go against the metrics, sometimes that's actually to your advantage and you should turn into the skid. People love to say, like, you know, Colorado hitters aren't that good. What if he didn't play in Colorado? Well, I don't care. Charlie Blackmon plays in Colorado. It doesn't really matter to me how good he'd be if he was on a different team at sea level, because he's not on a different team at sea level. So I think you really hit on something key there with FIP and Miley. And again, I want to bet what the Astros are betting.
Absolutely. If Miley leaves Houston, I mean, it's a 1-year contract. If he leaves Houston next year, unless he goes to somewhere like Tampa Bay, I'm out. You know, he probably won't even be on my draft list. But when the Astros picked him up, I kind of raised an eyebrow and they said he's going in our rotation for sure. I was like, okay, well, then he's going at least on my bench for his first couple starts and we'll take a look, if not in my rotation. And yeah, I just think, like you said, like, know the organizations to bet on. And in general, also maybe know some organizations that you don't want to bet on.
That's a great point, too. Yeah, there's certainly some toxic teams or teams. You know, for the longest time, the Orioles haven't been able to get a starting pitcher developed. And then we've seen some guys go other places and be successful. So it's like maybe starting pitchers and the Orioles don't mix. I'm going to go with a pseudo starting young starting pitcher. I guess he's in his later 20s now. I liked Matthew Boyd into the season. And this was a lot like your Eddie Rosario play in that it was based on one half of production. He was really good in the second half of last year. And you want to say, okay, why was he good? Well, he really found the feel of his slider. He started throwing it more. It became a put-away pitch for him. And so I thought, okay, this is a target I can probably get late in my drafts. I don't think the Tigers are going to be very good, but I do like Boyd. And then I looked at that division. I thought, okay, White Sox rebuilding, Royals. I mean, they're going to have like a 5 or 6 year rebuild. They have like 2 or 3 good players, it feels like, and that's it. And even the Indians off a playoff year. I mean, at that point, Lindor was hurt and Ramirez was coming off a horrible second half. I really didn't like their lineup. I thought they did a very poor job in free agency. So I started to realize that the AL Central might be a really soft landing spot for pitchers. And I started prioritizing getting as many guys as I could from that division. So this has all come together. Boyd, his ERA still maybe a little bit higher than I'd be comfortable with. The thing with Boyd is that even when he doesn't pitch well, it feels like he strikes out 7-8 guys anyway. So that every start has some depth to it. He goes 5, 6, 7 innings and he gets you a good contribution strikeouts. I feel like you get something useful from every one of his turns. And when he really has his good stuff, he went to the Yankees early this season, struck out 13 guys. That was before half their roster was hurt. So he's really doing some work there. He's since had another 13 strikeout game. I feel lucky that I'm getting overpaid for Boyd, just like with Yates. I would have been happy if the guy got 30, 35 saves. He's going to cruise past that. But again, I think it was a case of seeing that a pitcher had changed, tightened up his repertoire, had really found a wipeout pitch, and finding a division you could pick on. It seems like that has really worked in 2019.
Yeah, and I mean, to tie our last two players that we've now talked about together, I mean, I'm sure you've heard the rumors as a Boyd owner that the Astros are hot on his trail. I mean, could you imagine the value, the full season value you could get from Boyd? I mean, you've already got 142 strikeouts. If he winds up in Houston by the end of this month and pitches for that team for the last 2 months of the season, I mean, you know, he'll end up being the best or one of the best pitcher value picks of this season. I think he's still got to pitch well, but I mean, a 7.1 strikeout to walk rate. And then you go throw him on, you know, maybe, you know, the best team in the American League, probably. Sorry, Yankees fans. I think Houston's the best team in the American League. So, and the best place to pitch, like considering the support you have and the park. So if that trade happens, the sky's the limit, I think, for him.
I mean, from your mouth to the Roto God's ears, I hope that happens. I've heard those rumors too. And,
Yeah.
I mean, the Tigers really should be in a rebuild too. Now, the argument could also be that why aren't you rebuilding around Boyd? But you know, pitchers can run hot and cold. They don't know. Not every pitcher has a long length of success. Maybe just getting out on Boyd while the getting's good and getting a ton of stuff to restock the farm system would make sense. Of course, they really haven't seen the fruits of the Verlander trade come through yet, but maybe Cameron will wind up being a good play. I don't know. But I would love it if Boyd ended up in Houston. So anyway, that was my second hit. We'll go back to Fred for his number three hit of the 2019 season.
Yeah, this is one of my biggest as far as the jump in production. And I didn't think it would be to this degree, but I own DJ LeMahieu on a lot of teams. I didn't expect him to be. So when I was doing some articles for our site on first half fantasy awards and things like that, he's actually been the third most valuable hitter in the AL this year behind Devers and Trout. Like I didn't see that coming, but I did think that he wouldn't totally crater, you know, when he left Colorado. And I know this is something that you've talked about on this podcast before, where Coors Field hitters are always way better at Coors than they are on the road, but they struggle often on the road because of going back and forth between Coors. And when LeMahieu left for the Yankees, I thought, okay, well, this isn't Coors Field, but it's one of the two or three best parks in baseball to hit in. So he's still in a great park, but now he doesn't have to deal with that in and out of Coors Field effect. Yankees hitters don't have that same thing on the road. There's some really nice road parks in the American League East, right? Camden, Rogers Center, Fenway, some really nice parks to hit in. There's also a couple crummy pitching staffs right now in the American League East with Toronto and Baltimore. And I just thought that Yankees lineup was so loaded, you know, that LeMahieu, if he was even just still a 300 hitter, that he would collect plenty of runs and RBIs. Now, it's gone even better than I thought, and he's really stepped up for them with a 900 OPS. But and his price was so low. Like, I was getting him in 15-team leagues in round 16, 17, 18, so just kind of my middle infield guy. I felt like at that point, 300 hitters don't grow on trees anymore. So just a 300 hitter in a really good lineup was a really nice value then, and it's obviously gone a lot better than I expected. But for me, that takeaway was don't automatically dismiss hitters when they leave Coors Field, especially if they leave Coors but go to another hitting environment that's pretty favorable.
Yeah, I'm so glad you took what I was going to say is the main prong from that is the misunderstanding of Colorado splits. And when players leave there, people think, oh no, he's going to be this road hitter all the time, and it's just a totally different frame. I was wrong on LeMahieu, though. I thought he'd be useful for the Yankees, but I thought it would be at the bottom of the lineup. I thought he could even be squeezed if a couple of guys maybe came into value quicker than they expected. And what's happened is everybody but LeMahieu's been hurt, And you could argue he's been the team's MVP through the first half. I don't have any LeMahieu. I often had him in Colorado, but
absolutely,
I never saw this coming. I feel like I would have been open-minded to a LeMahieu pick. There was just other middle infielders maybe I liked more, and I'm going to talk about one in a second. But I tip my cap for your LeMahieu hit because I was nowhere near that. Well, I'll tell you something I was near is Marcus Semien. And this is one of the – I like to go with a lot of boring value vets on my team. I'm trying to skew those a little bit younger, and I'll get to that when I talk about some things that I've missed. But Semien's still in his 20s, and somebody who was off a 15 home run, 14 steal season. The previous year, he had 10 homers and 12 steals, and he only played 85 games. So I thought this guy maybe had 20-20 upside. And I looked at his career average, you know, 250 or so. I think people misunderstand batting average. They used to see a 250 average and think, oh no, this guy's going to hurt me. What if he hits 230? Even 250 will be a painful thing to my average. And now the whole league is, there's more strikeouts, there's less balls in play. The averages are sinking lower. ERAs are getting higher. And what you need to be competitive in those categories is a lot less than what it used to be. So I look at guys like Tim Anderson or Marcus Semien and don't think that, granted, they're both playing far better than I think people would reasonably expect. But even if those guys hit in the 250s, which they always generally seem to do, people are always afraid Tim Anderson's going to hit 230, and he never does. Anyway, Semien, I thought maybe he had 20-20 upside. His average wouldn't be a kill shot. Now, he's hitting 271. I don't expect him to keep that. He's got 14 home runs. I mean, this was his career high is 27. He has done that, but I mean, he's given me more power than I expect. Just 5 stolen bases. He's been caught 4 times, but just a case of, I think I identified a player who people were over. You know, we was banging the drum for Marcus Semien before the season. Again, you know, kind of boring. He's been around for a while. People think that maybe they know what his plateau is. So it's not the upside. He plays in a big park. That's a something that people try to stay away from. So I think it's just a boring value pick, but still in his 20s. So maybe there's some of the upside where he hasn't hit to the point where he's starting to fade. And I feel lucky that the power has been better than I expected and the average has been better than I expected. I'd be totally fine if we went back to being a 250 guy with power and speed. Maybe that's what the second half brings. But to this point, I'm enjoying the profits on Marcus Semien.
Yeah, I think it was something to be aware of with guys like Semien. I think those 15-15 guys, like 15 homers, 15 steal guys, are often underrated. They just kind of fly under the radar across the board. You know, the 75 RBIs, the 75 runs, it all adds up, but they get underrated. The 30 homer, zero steal guy, everybody knows about. The 15-15 guy who's just as valuable or more valuable with the premium on steals, those guys get swept under the rug. And I think Semien's a cool story. As you said, he's a boring veteran who's still in his 20s, and that's a nice place to be. And then I think he deserves all the credit in the world for making the improvements he's made. His walk to strikeout ratio has gone way up. So that's his hard work at the plate, you know, improving himself as an all-around offensive player. And then his defense has improved a lot, and that used to be a big problem for him. I think he's a really cool story, and I do think he flies under the radar because he's out there in Oakland, and he's not in the middle of the lineup, and he's just kind of another guy on a team that's kind of pesky and always around, but not, you know, at the top of the league. I agree. He's the perfect guy to fly under the radar and the kind of guy you look at in the second half of fantasy
draft. Yeah, you nailed a couple of great points. I should have mentioned the walk strikeout rate, but I mean, it's almost even. I always say that if you find anybody's walk strikeout rate is close to one, you should just start hugging strangers, or better yet, run to your computer, your phone, and pick up those players because they're almost always good values. I mean, that's how we could have gotten to the Tommy La Stella story in April. He improved his launch angle and he had this unbelievable walk strikeout rate, which he had owned for a while. It was very easy to buy in. It's too bad that he's hurt now and he might be a washout for the rest of the season. But as you said, Semien, the walk strikeout improvement and the defense, which is critical, especially when you play shortstop, because if you're a horrible defensive shortstop, you run the risk of being out of the lineup. And you know, so that's something he needed to do. And not only does it mark his place, his territory with the team and in the lineup, but it also just shows a willingness to improve, a willingness to self-evaluate, put the work in. And that just speaks well to that type of player could possibly improve. It just seems like somebody who wants to maximize his craft and be the best player he can possibly be. And you know, I like to think everybody wants to do that, but let's face it, some people try harder than others. Some people are more dedicated than others. And even though I'm not with Semien, never met the guy, I've never worked out with him, he wasn't in Moneyball, but you have a good sense that he's somebody who's trying to maximize his abilities. It's turned into a fantasy profit this season. So those are some of our hits. We don't have an endless amount of time. Now we're going to talk about some of the things we missed in the first half of 2019, whether they be regretful picks. Maybe we could have seen them coming. Maybe we couldn't have seen them coming. Fred, give us one of your regrets or one of your misses from 2019.
Well, I thought for sure that Daniel Murphy was going to be super successful in the Rockies, and it just hasn't really happened. I know he was hurt kind of at the start of the season, but injuries are a thing with Murphy, and I probably overlooked that a little bit. I thought he would easily be a 300 hitter with the Rockies, and he hasn't been. You know, he's hitting 274, which is fine, but 7 home runs, 26 runs scored. Like, it's pretty bad so far this year. I took him in the 5th round of a couple of 15 team leagues. I like Daniel Murphy. Like, I just like the skill set. Like, I looked at 2016 on the Nats, a 347 average, and 2017, a 322 average. And even last year, a 299 average, you know, when he bounced between two teams. And I thought, wow, on the Rockies, like, I thought he could hit 320 this year with probably, you know, 20 home runs. But I think where I made the mistakes there, I didn't fully, you know, think about his injury history. He's someone who, when everything goes right, plays about 140 games. That kind of guy, as he gets into like his like early to mid 30s, and Murphy's now 34, like that, when that guy gets into his mid 30s, that 140 game, even in his 20s kind of guy, is maybe a little too injury prone for me to believe in to the degree that I did. So I think that's something. And then something I've mentioned to you that I'm trying to really learn from is I'm trying to be actually more of an ageist overall and discount the players in their 30s, because I find they're not hanging on as much as they used to. And whether that's a PEDs thing, like when I started playing fantasy baseball late 90s, early 2000s, I found guys really hung on well into through their mid 30s. That's just not happening anymore. Guys seem to be getting worn down way more. Baseball seems to be a young man's game more than it ever was. And the guys who are the David Ortiz type players are more the exception than the rule. So I think that's something I'm going to try to remember through Murphy, through Joey Votto, who I have on a couple teams, is to try to really fade those mid 30s guys. And if I miss some of them who hang on longer than I think, then I guess that's okay.
Great piece of strategy there. I've fallen into it too. I bought Matt Carpenter, who, you know, I have a long affection for, and Joey Votto and Tout Wars, and that really hurt me. And rather be a year early than a year late, right? I mean, so you miss out on a year, maybe two, that's fine. Of course, the siren of Colorado is hard to say no to. I have a lot of Garrett Hampson shares that I deemed useless after 3 or 4 weeks. I've since repicked them up in a few leagues. I don't know if there'll be any staying power, but it's interesting how Hampson and McMahon, we thought maybe one of them would come into value, or maybe both of them. And just some teams, some slots don't have right answers. I'm not sure there's a right answer with those guys. And I agree, going younger, I think, is a great idea. I love young players with experience, actually. I think that's kind of become my pet thing. I've been putting together some of my fantasy football boards, and that's something I'm trying to prioritize. I love players who are young, but at least have been around the track once or twice. So you're getting the best of both worlds. You don't have to worry about the old player, but you have a player who has proven something, or at least putting something on the board. And in baseball, I think that is a good thing to follow as well. My biggest mistake this year was probably picking a friends and family date that Fred Zinke couldn't make. So I'll take the loss on that. But something I also did a bunch of, and did I regret it really quickly? I'm sure we probably talked about it early in the season, is I talked myself into Rick Porcello, Miles Mikolas, Kyle Hendricks, guys who have elite control and aren't dominant strikeout guys, thinking they know how to pitch, they're on winning teams, they'll get strikeouts through the innings pitch that they throw. So even though their K per nine may not be great, they'll actually contribute strikeouts in kind of a sneaky way. And then the season started, and the game, already morphing into a 3 true outcome game, or even a 2 true outcome game, became even more so like that. And, you know, Porcello's one of those guys, it seems like he, and on the right day, he can shut out the Yankees, and on the wrong day, the worst team in baseball can get 7 runs off him. I know everybody gets hit at some point, and everybody has a lucky game once in a while, but I feel like there's an extreme nature of that to Porcello, so I don't even feel like the matchups help me all that much, because I'll keep him away from a good team, and he'll pitch well, and then he'll come up with a stinker against a team I think he should beat. You know, Michaelis had only had that one great season after being in Japan. Maybe I put too much stock in that. It's not that these guys were season killers, because they all came at a reasonable price, and we're always looking for bargains. I know I am, but I feel like I didn't fully understand what I was getting into when I accepted too many pitch to contact guys in today's environment.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, strikeout numbers are so high now that I think you need a few of those. Like, you need some Matt Boyd types on your roster who get a ton of strikeouts. If you're full of pitch, you can have a good pitch to contact guy in your lineup. You know, like Wade Miley is that guy kind of for me on a lot of my teams. I have a bunch of Andrew Cashner, who's been pitching really well lately.
But Mike Fiers.
Yeah, Cashner's strikeout rate's really low. Like, I'm talking a K per nine of around 5 the last few starts, but he's pitching well. And in today's environment, you'll take it, but you can't have too many of them. Otherwise, yeah, you just, unless you're going to roll 9 starters and punt saves, other than that, you can't have a lot of pitch to contact guys.
Are you steering Cashner from any starts, or are you just saying, you know what, he's been good for long enough, I'm just going to let it fly?
I won't use him against the Red Sox or the Yankees. Coming up, I'm really hoping he gets traded. I know there's the rumors that he doesn't really want to get traded and that he wants to just stay in Baltimore. I'm really hoping he gets traded out of the AL East because he is pitching really well. But I've decided I'm using him for pretty much every start. So I used him in Toronto this week. It's not a good park to pitch him, but it's a fine lineup to go against, although the lineup's been a little better lately. But I'm using him for most starts. Like I said, I would fade him against New York and Boston and, you know, maybe Houston. If Houston was in Baltimore, I'd fade him. But for the most part, I'm leaving him in, mostly because you just don't have a lot of choice in 15-team leagues right now. Like, it's either use him or just grab Seth Lugo or someone like that and take your two or three innings and hope he doesn't give up a run.
I feel like there's been less findable pitching. I feel most seasons I can just go and dip in, even in a competitive league like Tout Wars or competitive league at the Yahoo Friends and Family League. I can usually find a pitcher when I need it. And a lot of times I've looked at teams and think, okay, I need a starting pitcher on this team. Maybe I need two. I'm not sure I can swing a trade because Zinke's not in the league this year. So where's this guy I can pick up? And I'm having trouble finding those guys. I just feel like there might be less supply. Mike Fiers has kind of turned into my version of your Cashner. And it's a little bit maybe more digestible because he's in that Oakland park behind with that great defense behind him. We talked about Simeon's a plus defender now. We know Matt Chapman's unbelievable at third base, just one of my favorite players. And happy to say I have a bunch of him. But, I mean, he's super on defense. Not strikeout sexy. I know he threw a no-hitter. That's a total fluke. Usually it's six innings, somewhere between two and three runs. Sometimes he allows four. But at least it seems like the downside is mitigated. Maybe you keep him out of Texas. That's the big park. That's a problem there. And I guess you have to kind of deal with the Astros too. But I like the home starts for Fiers. So he's a guy, you know, when you're looking for the cheap pitching, you mentioned Cashner. I'm kind of a Fiers guy. But I will take the loss on those control artists who I had more expectant. You know, I expected the middle of the staff guys. Now I'm just running away from Porcello. I don't want any part of him. Hendricks has actually been pretty good. Maybe he's unfairly lumped in with these other guys. And Michaelis, I've downgraded my expectations as well. Fred, give us another one of your regrets from the 2019 season.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Adalberto Mondesi right now because I know that you and I were opposed on him at the beginning of the year. And I was wrong, and I'll admit that for sure. And I'll explain kind of where I was coming from with him. So with Mondesi, his plate discipline is so incredibly bad. Like, his walk to strikeout ratio is below 0.2 in his career and this season. And when I see it, I know that there's guys out there. Adam Jones is one of them, for example, who can have long productive careers without having that traditional great batting eye where the walk to strikeout ratio is at least acceptable. I wasn't ready yet to make Mondesi one of those guys. I was scared off a couple of years ago by Rougned Odor, where when everything's going right for him as far as BABIP goes, they're good because they got power, they got speed, they're hitting for average. But then because they never walk, when their luck goes bad, they're just totally useless because they don't walk. So they're getting on base, you know, maybe 10-15% of the time, and that's it. That's what I was scared of with Mondesi. What I didn't give enough credit for was just the immense value these days of someone who can steal a lot of bases and just give you some help in the power categories too. And the fact that Mondesi, everybody saw it coming that he was going to steal at least 30, and now it looks like he'll steal somewhere in the 40s, probably for bases. That's just so incredibly valuable in roto leagues right now. And the fact that he can give you 12, 15 home runs on top of that, he's just a really valuable guy. And I should have looked past the walk to strikeout ratio and thought about just the incredible value of those steals. That being said, I still wouldn't be surprised to see Mondesi have a poor batting average in the second half. He's hitting .268 with a .351 BABIP. Like, if that BABIP drops, it could easily drop for a part of a season 50 points, and his batting average could be really low. So I'm not totally in on him, but I totally missed, like, all those leagues where I was chasing some of these veterans in the early rounds. I should have been going with Mondesi and locking up my steals.
Maybe this is a coincidence, but it's interesting that some of the best places to find stolen bases in today's landscape are on losing teams. I think sometimes it's because those teams just feel like they have nothing to lose. You know, they just don't need the old DGAF attitude on the stolen base paths. I look at when Jonathan Villar was traded to the Orioles last year, and it's nice to know that you're in the lineup every day and the team's prioritizing you. They put a value on you. But he just ran wild when he got to the Orioles. It's because, what do they care? They're going to lose 110 ball games anyway. Go ahead, knock yourselves out. I feel like the Royals are one of those teams. They don't have much to hang their hat on. They have a couple of good hitters at the top of the lineup, but it really gets thin quickly. A team that's years away from contention. Now, it's easy when guys are successful stealing bases. You can keep running, but I don't think they really care you know, it's not a time in baseball where the optimal strategy generally is to run, but the Orioles need to sell something. They need to have something to get fans to the park or something to put on the cover of the media guide or talk about on the telecast, whatever it is. They need something to pitch. And I feel like stolen bases are part of what they're hanging their hat on, much like the Orioles are one of those teams, or at least Jonathan Villar is. I'm not sure the Orioles are really running that much other than him. But just funny, I think of offense. I want guys on good offenses. But when it comes to stolen bases, I think maybe you need the team that's still playing in a form of baseball that doesn't really apply anymore. And sometimes you need a team that might be a part, maybe a revolution behind everybody else as far as optimizing strategy. So anyway, good thoughts on Mondesi. I do have some Mondesi shares. It's certainly the batting average risk hasn't gone away. And I think you have to be mindful of that. In one keeper league, we actually cashed out on Mondesi and took the money and ran. And I feel pretty good about that. But man, he sure does run when he gets on base and he still has the power. A pitcher I was wrong on this year is Patrick Corbin. It's always weird to be wrong on a guy who you were in on the previous season. Had a lot of Corbin last year. A friend of mine in baseball told me that he thought he was really close to putting it together before he got hurt the last time, and just felt like his slider was an absolute wipeout killer pitch. And I think I misdiagnosed a couple of things with Corbin. I think I overemphasized the fact that, okay, he really only has two pitches. I guess you can maybe break up his off-speed pitches into a couple different classifications, but I was worried he might be a two-pitch pitcher, and he might be throwing too many sliders, and maybe that would have an effect on him down the road. Now, I'm starting to see research that whole idea of how many sliders you throw, maybe that's really not that big of a deal once a pitcher is past a certain part of his career. And Corbin has proved he can be productive and a star, an all-star at this level with only throwing those two pitches. So I think I baked in a lot of risk to Corbin that probably wasn't there, and one of these guys I knew I wasn't going to draft this year. I didn't want to pay the upgraded price for him. And I feel like that's been a miss. I feel like every time he goes out and pitches well, I feel like, man, I'm not in on any of this. And it's kind of frustrating to watch it.
Yeah, I can see that. I have no Corbin shares either, but I was fine with them. I was like, just kind of had them competitively priced and just didn't really end up with them. But I think that is a non-fantasy thought. I think that the resurgence of the Nationals might be my favorite story in baseball right now, and whether or not they can keep this going and climb all the way back up in that race and catch the Braves. I just think it's a really cool story because a lot of people had them kind of dead and buried in a couple months into the season, and what Scherzer's doing right now. And then he's got support with Corbin, Strasburg. I'm interested to see that. And I think it'd be really cool if the Nationals lost Bryce Harper and then
right had a terrible Ewing, the old season, Ewing then, theory, right? You know the Patrick Ewing theory? I think Bill Simmons and one of his readers, or maybe one of his editors, came up with this, the idea that a team has a player who dominates the landscape of that team so much that when they actually eliminate that player, the team might be better off. And Patrick Ewing being one of the great examples of this. Remember when Alex Rodriguez left the Mariners and they had, I think, that 116-win team the next season? It helped that Ichiro came over from Japan that year. But this would be a great test of the Ewing theory, right? I mean, Bryce Harper, a lot of stars in that Washington roster, but Harper was probably the number one star. No offense to Scherzer, some of the other guys there. Strasburg's a star. I can't believe Anthony Rendon has been off the All-Star team for so long because he's so good. But that would be a really a fun story to see that happen. And it's interesting how Scherzer couldn't buy a win, and now the last 5 or 6 weeks, he looks like the guy. He looks like the one guy. I think if you were drafting now, if you were to take Scherzer first or second, I can't say you're wrong.
Oh, totally agree. I think if I had to bet money on one guy to be the most valuable fantasy asset from this point forward, it'd be Scherzer. I mean, whether he's the most valuable asset to your team or not depends on where you are in the standings and what you need. But Scherzer is, you know, Scherzer, Trout, Yelich, like those guys. I wouldn't draft Scherzer first in a 2020 draft, but for the rest of the season, like, he's as good a bet as anyone. And Kershaw was when he was in his prime a few years ago too. The best fantasy pitcher is for sure, especially in this environment, is as valuable as the best fantasy hitter.
The correlation is so clean. Again, I'm not trying to make it a fantasy football podcast. Liz Loza and Matt Harmon, by the way, doing tremendous work on the Yahoo Fantasy Football podcast. So check those guys out. The running backs of fantasy football are the starting pitchers of fantasy baseball. Yes, they have injury risk. Yes, they're fickle. Yes, they can drive us crazy. But if you hit on the right guy, they can absolutely drive you to a championship. Just a few minutes left in the baseball portion of this program. We're going to transition to a draft shortly. Fred, in the speed round, give us one more thing you've missed in 2019.
Yeah, I missed big on David Robertson. I thought I tried when you talk about how you nailed Kirby Yates, I tried to outsmart the closer pool in a couple leagues, and Robertson was going another tier after Yates and some of the closers around him. I tried to wait through there, get Robertson cheap because Gabe Kapler was saying he wasn't going to settle on a closer. I thought he was kind of full of it and that Robertson was their best reliever and he would settle on him and the Phillies would be good and Robertson had saved 35 games. I think Robertson was just never healthy. I mean, he only threw 6 2/3 innings so far this season. He might help them down the stretch, but the fantasy value is done. I think the lesson learned there for me is, first of all, listen to the manager. I maybe a little more than I did. Kapler was saying he wasn't going to have a set closer. And then just the fickleness of relievers, like just to not forget that. I mean, Robertson had pitched really well for several seasons in a row. And then this year just, you know, absolutely no value to pick someone. I think I picked him around round 10 or 11 in the 15 team leagues. And then to have to drop him by the end of April was a really tough one.
Totally fair on that. It's funny when you pick the wrong closer, you land on the wrong closer, man. Does that leave a mark? At least you moved on from it. Maybe you got some Hector Neris here and there, although not that he's a perfect patchwork guy, but he's had a pretty nice season. Kapler can be a frustrating manager too, because it's just hard to know what he's going to do sometimes. I think most managers would like to have a set closer, but it doesn't mean that they certainly have to. We know the Red Sox have been fine without having one this year. I mean, they've been struggling to find answers, but I mean, they don't seem to be landing on a guy. Maybe Nathan Eovaldi is that player. I think they could also be in the trade market. We mentioned Will Smith earlier. For my final miss, again, speed round, I'm going to mention Dansby Swanson. I'm in a keeper league with guys I grew up with. I call it my hometown league, even though it's based out of Massachusetts and I live in Michigan now. 476 players are rostered after draft day. That includes keepers and players we draft. We did not draft Dansby Swanson. So I'm going to take the hit, but the other 13 owners in this league are going to take the hit with me. 476 picks, no Dansby Swanson. And why? He had 14 home runs last year and 10 stolen bases. I know the average stunk, 238. But he was a top five prospect. Not, you know, 2 years ago, 2017, he was into an age 25 season. Now, granted, Don Port, a friend of mine, longtime friend of mine, picked up Swanson early in the year, so good on him. Swanson ends up blossoming, 270, 17 home runs, 7 stolen bases. Just really looks like a star player that he was always projected to be. Age 25, why can't he figure it out? It's not that you had to pay, again, an expectant price. He didn't have to be one of your starters. But he already showed category juice. He's always had a pedigree. The age was right. The team was committed. I just can't believe we had 476 chances to draft Dansby Swanson and we never got it right.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And people weren't believing in him when he was initially breaking out at the beginning of the year. I mean, Swanson was hitting well right from April and people weren't picking him up. I don't know why. I don't really get it. And maybe it's the same as that Marcus Semien thing, right? Like an underrated, you know, across the board helper who just doesn't have a dominant category. So nobody jumps on him.
One of my favorite type of players, Bill James said a long time ago, they thought specialists in baseball tended to be overrated and players who were good at a lot of different things were often underrated. And I find myself trying to lean towards those broad skilled players. And you also mentioned, you talked about the 30 home run, zero steal guy versus the 15-15 guy and how there's sometimes a gap in the perception there. I think that's also true with runs scored and RBIs, where if somebody drives in 90 runs and scores 60, I think people don't understand that 60 runs is really bad. And you need to fix that. I think of a player to a lesser extent that Michael Franco was before this season, where he didn't score any runs because he's slow and he hits low in the lineup. I love runs scored. My teams are almost always good in runs scored because that means you have guys who are getting on base. You have guys who are in good lineup spots, usually in good lineups. Get runs scored. I think it's the category of the 5x5 batting average is close. I think runs scored are the category that you can pay for it, but yet not have to pay full sticker for it. I just think there's like a value there because people they like home runs. They like RBIs. They grew up with stuff like that. Runs scored are not part of the Triple Crown. Nobody says, oh, remember the year Lenny Dykstra scored 143 runs. I think of it, but I think other people don't. Runs scored are an underserved fantasy category. Keep that in mind when you're making pickups and keep that in mind when you're assembling your team for next year.
Yeah, very true.
All right. Well, there are some of our hits. There are some of our errors, some of our regrets from the first half. Hopefully you got something out of that and share yours at the Yahoo Fantasy tag or get Fred on Twitter. He's at Fred Zinke MLB. I'm at Scott_Pianowski. Nothing better than talking baseball with Fred. And now we're going to go to our draft, most important draft in the history of mankind. It's also the first time this year I have had the draft idea come from one of my guests. I've come up with all the other draft ideas. And if you don't like them, you can blame me. You can send a letter to my Gettysburg address. But Fred said to me a couple days ago, he said, hey, why don't we draft Freds? I said, you know, that is a great idea. Why don't we draft Freds? So that's what we're going to do today. Five rounds, back and forth. Fred's going to have the first pick. And there's just one rule in the Fred draft. Fred Zinke is ineligible. The NCAA said he did not qualify. Something, I don't know. I think you get a free sandwich from an agent or something. So you were ineligible to be drafted in the Zinke, in the Fred draft. It's still available in the Zinke draft, by the way, but ineligible in the Fred draft.
That would be a tough draft.
Yeah. Other than that, Mr. Zinke, you have the first pick. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I picked this draft because I think Fred is growing up as a Fred. There aren't many of us out there anymore. It's not a weird name, but it's certainly not a common name. So they always cross when I do see a Fred. It always kind of resonates with me. My first pick, since I'm Canadian and actually live about an hour away from Toronto, so my first pick, which is timely for a July draft, is Fred VanVleet. Just celebrating the Raptors and that incredible championship run that was so unlikely. I'm telling you, I would have bet my mortgage that the Raptors would not be the next Toronto sports team to win a major championship, just with how the NBA is a players' league and players pick where they go, and Toronto's not a prime destination for them. I never thought it would happen. And Fred VanVleet was such a cool story and such an underrated part of that team, where he, if you really watch the entire, you know, NBA playoffs, there was a stretch where he just could not get it done offensively. Like, he wasn't hitting anything. And then all of a sudden his child was born. And as soon as his child was born, he just became red hot. And for the rest of the playoffs, it was like he couldn't miss. And, you know, I think he even got one vote for finals MVP. And I mean, that vote's slightly ridiculous, but just the fact that Fred VanVleet got a vote for finals MVP and was, you know, at one point in that very final game, for a while, was probably the best player on the Raptors. You know, there was a time when Kawhi went quiet and VanVleet kind of carried them like early fourth quarter. So just connecting that name and what just happened in Toronto, something that I don't think people in Toronto are going to see again, a Raptors championship for a really, really long time. I believe in Masai Ujiri, but I think that NBA deck is stacked against Toronto.
That's a great pick. I'm not sure where it would have been on my board, but certainly fresh in my mind. I'm a casual NBA fan. I follow just about every sport other than NASCAR and bike racing. I'm not really that big of a tennis fan anymore, but I follow everything else. I'm a huge hockey guy. Obviously, baseball and football are a huge part of what we do at Yahoo. I follow the NBA more casually, but I was rooting for the Raptors. I thought it was a very easy team to like. When your Kawhi Leonard is your star, he's such a non-star superstar where he's not about branding himself, and you know, he made his decision with the free agency after everybody else. I just like everything. I like the cut of his jib. I just like everything about Kawhi, and I like how this team shared the ball. And Fred VanVleet, a big part of their championship, props to him. And an excellent pick in our Fred draft. You know, there's somebody, if I thought you were at risk of picking who I would really pick first, I'd pick this, somebody different. But I'm going to try to think about what you're going to do here. I'm going to get a little strategic here. I want to win this Fred draft. So I'm going to take Freddie Freeman, who just one of my favorite hitters. Just a guy, unbelievable. I think Joey Votto has been justly praised for his unbelievable strike zone judgment. I think Freeman's right there with him, where he just spits on borderline pitches, hits the ball to all fields, hits with power. A lineup, a team that's really fun right now. We mentioned earlier with Swanson, I mean, obviously they have Acuna. They have so many young players in this lineup who are just killing it right now. Riley has been a terrific player. I wish I had more shares of him, just one. I had to trade for him too. I paid way too much for him, but I had a lot of FOMO with Riley. But Freddie Freeman's their number three guy. I grew up at a time where the best hitter hit number three, and I kind of still like that idea. I know there's been some analysis that maybe the best hitter should really hit second. We know that was Votto's place for so many years in Cincinnati. I guess it still is, but I don't know. To me, I just think of George Brett. Fred Freeman to me is like a George Brett type of hitter, just a natural born guy who just comes out of the chute hitting ropes. There's really no pitch he can't hit. I always feel like he's going to do something good in every at-bat. One of my favorite, probably my favorite hitter in the game today. Mookie Betts is my favorite player, but my favorite pure hitter is probably Freddie Freeman. I'm going to make him my first pick in the Fred draft.
Oh, that's a really good one. And connecting him with me, that both of Freddie Freeman's parents are Canadian. And of course, he has been able to play for Canada, even though Freddie Freeman's American and grew up in America, but is able to play for Canada in some of those international baseball competitions, which for the Canadian team is obviously a huge win since they're not really stocked with great MLB players. I'm going to take in the second round, I'm going to go back to 80s wrestling, and I'm going to take Classy Freddie Blassie. I have zero interest in wrestling from probably about 1990 to 95 on till today. I'm not interested in wrestling as an adult. I really was into it as a teenager, but there was a time when I was a little kid when I believed that wrestling was real. And I get that it's still real, that they're throwing each other around, but where I believed that the wrestlers really didn't like each other and that it wasn't, you know, set up. And I will say when I was about 7, 8, 9 years old, watching wrestling was about as much fun as I've ever had watching sports, because when you believed that those wrestlers really didn't like each other and were really out to get each other, the drama of it was amazing. And Classy Freddie Blassie was one of those cool managers who, you know, was always the bad guy, always doing stuff that got everybody riled up. And like I said, when I have great memories of being a little kid and watching it and just thinking, you know, how could he get away with that? How did they not catch him there? And all those things. And then eventually I'd say I got to be about 10 years old and realized that it was much more scripted than and that a lot of these guys were friends behind the scenes and everything. But for that time when I really believed in wrestling, it was amazing. So I'll take Classy Freddie Blassie, like a really cool 80s wrestler. I have a soft spot for probably anyone involved in 80s WWF.
I'll admit that is, I talked about the sports I don't follow. That's one of the ones I've never really known a lot about. So you probably could have taken him in any round.
Probably.
I'll tell you, with a nod towards wrestling, I always thought wrestling was kind of a cartoon show. So I'm going to pick a cartoon character. I'm going to pick Fred Flintstone. I'm not the biggest cartoon guy in the world, but I always thought the Flintstones was a great show, obviously based on the Honeymooners. Clever, creative, and every once in a while a baseball callback. I remember Fred Flintstone talking about Mickey Mantlepiece, just hit a couple more home runs, not bad. I don't know. I thought it was a well-written show. Fred, you get all the emotions with him. A lot of times he's hot-headed. But he's really sweet to Wilma. He goes to work every day, puts his time in. I hope he's got a nice pension and is retired now and maybe living in a condo or something in a nice part of Bedrock. But Fred Flintstone, good show, good cartoon, good guy. I mean, I think he's a good heart at the end of the day with Fred. Again, he flies off the handle sometimes, but I think he probably would be easy to beat in your fantasy league because he'd probably be impetuous. He'd probably do the probably get in that mode where you had to make a trade to make a trade. He'd probably screw up his team and then probably blame it on Barney or something. But Fred Flintstone's a good guy. It's a good show. He's going to be my second pick in the Fred draft.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many lunches I had as a kid watching the Flintstones. That was a great. They were always on at 12 o'clock where I was, and I'd always watch the Flintstones. So I think that's a great pick. I'm going to go closer to the real sporting world now than wrestling. My next pick is going to be Fred Taylor. I found those Jacksonville Jaguar teams with Fred Taylor and Mark Brunell and Jimmy Smith to be like really fun teams. And I just found Fred Taylor in fantasy football to be like a really fun running back. Like when everything's going right with Fred Taylor, he was an amazing combination of speed, power, elusiveness. He had some really great seasons, but he was a little bit, I found him a little bit maddeningly inconsistent, where some years he wouldn't score touchdowns, or maybe he'd have a nagging injury some years. Like he will never be confused with LaDainian Tomlinson or Emmett Smith as far as just being a consistent stud. But peak Fred Taylor, when he's really on his game, was pretty awesome. And, you know, Fred Taylor's prime was before I was working in fantasy and just playing a ton of fantasy. And he was someone who I was always excited to own, sometimes drove me nuts. And I think as far as athletically, one of the best Freds to come along in my lifetime.
That's a great pick. You know, a couple of takeaways with Fred Taylor. One, when he first came in the league, he got hurt a lot and got the tag Fragile Fred. And then that just went away. I think part of it is he really cared about his body and maybe made some changes, but maybe just part of it was he started to get luckier, where, you know, the kill shot before that was taking him out the knee, that player missed or he juked him or something like that. Could run it, could catch it, could run inside with power, aged better than people, I think, remember, and also just had some gears. I remember he had a 90-yard touchdown run that I watched over and over again back when it was hard to get highlights. It wasn't like it was to now. You can call up anything on your phone in like 5 seconds, but he was a fun guy. And also remember the year Jacksonville was expected to go to the Super Bowl, that year Tennessee beat them in the late 90s. Tennessee beat them three times, twice in the regular season, and then Tennessee beat them in the AFC Championship game. And I believe it was Fred Taylor who said at the end of the game, you know, I still think we're better. They had lost to Tennessee three straight times, and they still had the swagger to say, yeah, I think we got the better team. They beat us today, whatever. But Fred Taylor was a fun player. I had a cup of coffee with the Patriots at the end of his career, and I think that speaks to the type of player he was. And the Patriots love that type of veteran. They like to get him on the rebound. They don't always work out as home run picks, but you know, anyway, I think that speaks to if you're good enough for Belichick, you're good enough for me, and you're certainly good enough for our 5-round Fred draft. Talking to Fred Zinke, our man on the ground in Toronto, great Yahoo fantasy analyst, and we're drafting Fred's at Fred's suggestion. We may not take Fred Zinke. He's eligible for this draft. I don't think this is somebody you'd pick. I don't know that you're a golf fan, but I'm just going to do it. I'm going to take Fred Couples, who's my favorite player of all time, because he's a lot of people think golf is a stuffy sport and a non-inclusive sport, and some of those things may be true. But if you watch Fred Couples in his peak, just the coolest guy. He swung from his heels. He hit the ball a mile. His shirts just looked perfectly fitting. He walked down with his gait down the fairway. He just looked unconcerned about anything in the world. He used to say he never answered his phone because he thought somebody else might be there. He just wanted to kind of sack out on the couch and be lazy. Just something cool about Fred Couples. He has this functional aloofness that I think we should all aspire to have on some level. Maybe should have won a little bit more. He did win a Masters in 1992, a famous Velcro shot. He hits a ball in a par three. It should have rolled in the water. Somehow it didn't. He ends up winning the tournament. You can read about that in the Sports Illustrated archives if you're so inclined. Also, a lot of the highlights are on YouTube. The bottom line is golf isn't always a cool sport, but Fred Couples was incredibly cool. Always been my favorite golfer, and thrilled to get him in round three of the Fred draft.
I actually did think about Fred Couples, even though I'm not really an avid golf fan. So I think that shows, you know, how good he was and how memorable he was. Just that when I kind of made a quick short list, you and I talked before we started recording about how neither one of us, you know, took to the internet to think of our Freds. We both kind of thought of them organically, just, you know, sat and kind of brainstormed Freds. He did come into my mind. I didn't pick him, but I think that kind of shows because I'm not a big golf fan.
That's my rule on this podcast. I'm fine with internet research for the baseball. I refuse to do internet research for the draft. It has to be an organic thing. To me, I think in the spirit of this draft, it's like we were sitting in a bar or we were driving somewhere together. We're just hanging out, you know, playing poker or, you know, whatever, doing something, you know, having a meal together. And we just decided to do this off the top of our heads. I feel like that should be the spirit of these drafts.
I agree. And so my next pick, I'm pretty sure I could leave this one to the end too, but because this one's be a little obscure, but my next pick is going to be Fred Young. So Fred Young, linebacker from the Seahawks, and there's a reason I'm picking him, linebacker from the Seahawks in the 80s. One thing about Fred Young that's so weird and kind of cool is I think he's the only guy I've ever seen spell Fred with two D's at the end. I don't think I've ever seen anyone else put two D's at the end of Fred. F-R-E-D-D is such a weird way to spell it. And that always caught my attention. But the real reason I'm picking him, for people who played Tecmo Bowl, I don't know, Scott, if you ever played Tecmo Bowl on Nintendo when you were a kid.
Bo Jackson.
Yeah. So Fred Young was one of the best players in Tecmo Bowl. And I don't know exactly why. I think he was way better in Tecmo Bowl than he was as a real life player. But on the Seahawks defense, he had something like 18 sacks or something in the game, which made him like a lights out linebacker and one of the best players to have in the game. And Tecmo Bowl was kind of how I cut my teeth as like a football fan. Like growing up in Canada, I wasn't a football fan until I was maybe about 11 or 12 years old and kind of found it on my own and then got really into it. And playing that video game, you know, like almost until I wore it out with my brother and some of my friends. And Fred, anyone who's really into Tecmo Bowl, I know Derek Van Riper, a friend of ours who works at The Athletic, is really into that game. Anyone who was really into Tecmo Bowl will remember that Fred Young was one of the best players in the game and someone who you used as your defensive pick all the time. And like I said, him spelling Fred with two D's is just really weird to me. So I decided I was going to pick him. He was one of the Freds that first popped into my head.
Awesome pick. I mean, we know in fantasy, one of the most important things is to find players who might be more valuable in fantasy than they are in real life. And that's certainly a key to video games is to find that player who I don't know if he knew the game designers or it's just a fluke of the way the thing was set up, but you just have these guys who for whatever reason are superhuman, even though they might not be in real life. And sounds like Fred Young was that type of player. I wasn't aware of that to pick him, but I think it's a great pick. Outstanding. And by the way, I'm going to have so many leftovers. It'll be curious to see some of the guys we don't draft. And if producer Brett is listening in his ear, start assembling some of your Freds because we may have some leftovers that you can pick through. Your team may end up being as strong as ours because Fred has turned into a stronger draft than I expected. I'm going to take Fred Sanford in the fourth round. I think Sanford sounds an okay show. I think it's maybe a little bit overrated because everybody knows how great the theme song is. And you watch the show and it's all right. But Fred's got these old man sweaters. He's got these friends with these great names like Grady and Bubba. And, you know, I think one of one of Lamont's friends was Rolo. It's just it's a wonderfully dated show. Red Fox is unapologetically him, and the theme is awesome. So give me and also he'd also tell you it wasn't just Fred Sanford. It was Fred G. Stanford. The G stands for great. I think he's a great pick in the fourth round of the Fred draft.
Very nice. And actually, my fifth round, like my last pick, will be another kind of older, you know, pick. My pick's going to be Fred Gwynn as my last pick. I turned, full disclosure, I turned 42 yesterday. So I'm not old enough to have watched black and white TV shows, you know, new, but I am at that age where they were on in reruns and watched lots of Leave It to Beaver and everything. And one of my favorite rerun shows when I was a little kid was The Munsters. And I loved Fred Gwynn's character of Herman Munster and thought he was amazing. And then obviously later he was really good in a lot of movies, including My Cousin Vinny. But I picked him because of how good he was in The Munsters. And I always remember watching The Munsters as a kid. I was never an Addams Family guy. I always thought The Munsters was a way better show. And Fred Gwynn for his Herman Munster, I knew I'd be able to save him till the end because he wouldn't be a popular pick. But I thought he was a really good actor.
Nice pick. I agree with the Addams Family and The Munsters. You really need to pick a lane. It's going to be one or the other. Totally agree. You can't like both of them. It's like you can't like the Mets and the Yankees. You got to like one or the other.
Yeah.
A great pick in the fifth round. And you know what's funny? It is the fifth round, so I think this pick I'm going to make is even more appropriate. I'm going to go with Fab Five Freddy, the hip-hop pioneer, in the fifth round. Happy to get him here. One of the pioneers of the genre. He rapped on some of the early work by Blondie, including Rapture, which many people consider one of the first rap songs. And just a guy, Yo MTV rap staple, and a really cool dude. And the nice thing about this Fab Five Freddy pick is not only do I get Fab Five Freddy, but there's somebody who follows me who I really enjoy on Twitter who goes by Fab Five Freddy with the extra A. So it's like free agent acquisition budget Five Freddy. And this is a guy who I interact with sometimes on Twitter, and he's just a cool guy. I love the idea of it. I love that Freddie Freeman, by the way, wears number five. So I don't know. This kind of ties my team together. I got this guy in the fifth round. I had Freeman earlier. I kind of get the side pick of that guy I like on Twitter. In the fifth round, I'm going to take Fab Five Freddy. Lots of good Freds on the board that didn't get picked. Producer Brett, if you're out there, is there a Fred that you had your eye on that we did not mention?
Two good Freds and one joke Fred for you. Freddie Mercury. Come on, guys.
Okay.
Doesn't feel like a yes. Fred.
Thought about it.
On my board. You know, Gene McCaffrey in my head saying Queen's overrated.
Doesn't feel like a Fred, you know, in the way that a Fred Flintstone is. Like, doesn't feel like a Fred. But he is a Fred. He's a Freddie Mercury, Fred Rogers, a.k.a. Mr. Yes. Rogers, and then also Fred Durst. Why not? Why not throw Limp Bizkit in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, really good ones. I was also considering Fred, the Brazilian soccer player who just goes by Fred, which is awesome. I love soccer players who have one name. The Fred from, I believe Fred is one of the Scooby-Doo characters, where every Scooby-Doo mystery is the same, where halfway through Fred and Daphne disappear, and then the other three have to solve the mystery.
Oh,
and then,
I never thought of that one.
That's I almost went with him. Fred Grandy was Gopher in The Love Boat, a horrible show. He ended up being a congressman, I want to say. He was in The Match Game a lot. Seemed like a nice enough guy. So if I was really stuck, I might have gone one of those. I agree with Brett. The Freddie Mercury is a glaring omission from this draft. I guess I'm kind of reevaluating Queen. They're a band that I thought I really liked at one point, and then I downloaded like their whole catalog and realized I really just like the Queen that I like. There's a lot of Queen that I don't like, but still unbelievable voice. I mean, just a sweet, generous recording artist. There's nobody like Freddie Mercury. So I think he is somebody, a glaring omission, and certainly a great free agent pickup for Brett in the Fred draft.
Most definitely. I did think about going. I must admit that some of the Freds were so obvious, like Mercury, that then I started to kind of, my brain started to kind of go towards more obscure Freds just for the interest sake of finding some of the more obscure ones. But yeah, those ones, especially, and Fred Durst was one of the first ones to come into my head as well.
To which I will say, right, said Fred. That's a wrap on our pod. That is a wrap on our draft. Because it was your birthday, Fred, I thought I'd give you the draft topic as a present. I hope that spends well all season. Enjoy your 42nd year. I want to thank everybody who's been with us for the first half of this podcast, having a ball on it. If you like it, why not tell a friend, subscribe, give it a review where you get your podcasts, iTunes, give us a review on Stitcher, wherever you like. There's all sorts of places to aggregate. For our excellent guest, Fred Zinke, Fred Zinke MLB on Twitter. For producer Brett, doing a great job getting us out there to you and keeping us sounding great. I am Scott Pianowski. The first half is a wrap. We're going to attack the second half next week. Enjoy the break. We'll talk to you soon.